No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show that will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. And tonight, we have a very special guest, a long-term Washingtonian, I think a supporter of D.C. statehood, a consumer advocate, a lawyer, an author, a presidential candidate. If you don't know who Ralph Nader is, it's because you've been living under a rock for the last 50 years, because this man has changed the face of America and has made us all safer and better for his efforts. It's exciting to have you on the show, Mr. Nader. Thanks so much.
Thank you much, Mr. Brown.
Let me ask you, Mr. Nader, you know, consumerism is different today, the shape of it, because of the work that you've done. Your book, your classic book, Unsafe at Any Speed, shone a light on the auto industry. You know, I was talking to my kids the other day, and one, they're all adults now and they drive, and one of them said to me, well, you didn't have seatbelts in your cars when you were a kid, Dad. And I said, yes, we did. We had them. We just pushed them down under the seat. Nobody ever wore them. Now my children wouldn't even think about getting in a car as adults without seatbelts on. You really have changed the world, and you've saved countless lives. What's the next big hurdle for consumers?
Well, thank you very much. It just shows, you know, when people say legislation doesn't change people's behavior, well, that's a perfect example. I remember there was a time when people would call us un-American for urging seatbelt installation and use. And now you see, you know, the most Trump-oriented truck driver getting in a truck and without even giving it a thought, put the seat, three-point seatbelt on. So it's become just a given. And the big problem today, there's so many. One is, of course, is the gouging of the pharmaceutical industry. It's a pay-or-die industry that has got an iron lock on Congress, as you know. They have about 450 full-time lobbyists on 535 members of Congress, and they pour money in. And no matter how many times the politicians say, we're going to control drug prices, and presidents say, we're going to control drug prices, including, you know, Bush said it, Trump said it, Obama said it, Clinton said it, it doesn't happen. And so that is a menace, because a good many of the most important drugs are developed with taxpayer money through the National Institutes of Health, especially anti-cancer drugs. Even the Department of Defense had a drug research and development program, developed some of the anti-malarial drugs and other important drugs for a fraction of what the drug companies say they have to spend on R&D. Of course, we know they spend more on advertising and promotion, the drug companies, than on R&D. Another area that's just exploding is the control of people's money. It doesn't matter now. If you go into the credit card, internet, gulag, they control your money, which means they can deduct any penalty without even asking you. They can deduct any so-called late payment fee, any kind of gouging. You have the rent-to-own rackets, the pay-to-loan rackets, where the interest rate can go 4, 5, 600% as it multiplies itself after different due dates to pay off the loan. And people are in contract peonage, contract servitude. It's never been worse. People don't really know anymore that they've lost the freedom of contract because they just grow up assuming you sign on the dotted line with a fine print contract. You give up all kinds of rights on page 5, 6, 8, 10, and you click on. The companies are now trying to sell through parents credit cards for two-year-olds. Michelle Singletary, who you know, the consumer columnist for the Washington Post, wrote a whole article on that. These are electronic child molesters. These corporations are circumventing parental discipline and control and basically abducting these children with the iPhone 5, 6, 7 hours a day. And parents don't know what they're looking at, what they're being lured, tempted, addicted into. And this is new. This is, you know, since the internet iPhone connection started about 2008. And there's no end to it in terms of how many bread and butter issues this touches. So we've lost control of our kids. There's a new book out by Susan Lin, and the title is Who's Raising the Kids? Big Tech? Yeah. Big Business? Or who? Good question. My sister, Claire Naders, just put out a book speaking directly to 9 to 12-year-olds, not speaking down to them, on 54 different topics to get their intellect, their imagination, and curiosity liberated from dead-end instruction or the internet gulag and the corporatization of their lives. It's called You Are Your Own Best Teacher, sparking the curiosity, imagination, and intellect of tweens. And it's also, of course, for their family. And she has a very unique approach, which is everything starts with a conversation in the family, in the household. You talk to civil rights leaders, environmental leaders in their 50s, 60s. You say, how'd you get into this? Well, you know, we had a good conversation. The parents took us to a rally or a march or a meeting. And that's what this book, You Are Your Own Best Teacher, is all about. You think we could get the Washington Post to review it? No way. New York Times? No way. They review all kinds of mush and trivia and flamboyant nonsense. But something that has never been done before, talking directly to these children about serious topics that they're going to have to either contend with in future years or they're contending with right now. And it's just not getting enough attention. But so the problem is the breakup of the family by corporate hucksters, sell them junk food, junk drink, you know, all the problems affecting kids on that one, overweight, early hypertension, young diabetes, and so forth. Sell them all kinds of harmful other products, cosmetics to girls at age 6, war toys to boys at age 5. They're out of control. And they'll almost never hear about corporate power, corporate coercion, corporate control in the campaigns. Whether this year or prior years. It's a taboo subject. It's the 800-pound gorilla. And I think our job as civic advocates is to make corporate reform the big issue because they control everything they touch, and they touch just about everything. They're not only raising our children, they are strategically planning our elections, who gets nominated, our military budget, our public budgets, draining public money for community restoration. They decide what kind of food they want to sell us. They decide even patenting our genetic inheritance, for heaven's sake. Never mind, they're shaping the tax laws and the housing issues, the land issues, the installation of conditions for poverty, entrenched poverty, exploiting the poor pay more. So you can see, Mr. Yeah. Brown, there's a whole new arena of consumer injustice that a lot of consumer groups haven't caught up with yet.
Well, you can tell your sister she sold at least one more copy of the book, because Mrs. Brown, who is a librarian, started a financial, helped start, launch a financial courses for kids at her elementary school to make them more aware. Yeah, and, you know, and it's something that, you're right, is absolutely desperately needed. But let me ask you, are corporations being any more responsible, or are they just manipulating more PR? You know, you have Kanye West, for example, that's been dropped by everybody for his anti-Semitic video, and Carrie Irvin, who plays for the new Brooklyn Nets, being suspended for similar activity. Are we just seeing more diversity in commercials, for example, where we see the black child, the white child, the Native American child, or are corporations changing, you think, at all?
Well, the advances we had in the 60s and 70s, they're still, in many respects, have to obey them. So they have to put seatbelts in cars, for example. Mm-hmm. They have to meet certain safety standards, food labeling standards, and disclosure standards. And they haven't been able to overturn that. But in over 50 years of activity, I've never seen corporations more powerful. In fact, corporations are more powerful in the U.S. than they are in any Western country, because other Western countries have social safety nets. They have universal health care, paid child care. They have better pensions, have higher minimum wage, better public transit, stronger labor unions. This country's like a colony. It's not just D.C. D.C.'s a special type of colony within a larger American colony in terms of getting their way. But now, they're very clever now. If you read the New York Times and you look carefully at the ads, especially the New York Times Magazine, in the last 3 years, especially after the George Floyd murder, my rough guess is that after decades of never having a black model, modeling shoes, clothes, other things, or Hispanic or Asian, almost half of the ads are now black and brown models. And the ads are for products, sky-high prices, you know, $2,000 suits, $1,000 shoes. Nobody, except a very few in the minority community, can even begin to think. So it's just symbolism. It's the equivalent of greenwashing in the environmental area. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, you can exploit people. You can fill their bodies with deadly pollutants and their children, and they all get sick. And these CEOs stay at the top and keep making money. Like Tim Cook, you may not believe this, Mr. Brown, or your listeners. I calculated Tim Cook, the chairman of Apple. He's making this year $833 a minute on a 40-hour week. So while they're symbolically adapting to the change of certain mores and diversity, they're still exploiting all kinds of people in the old way, in the workplace, in the factories, the foundries, in the migrant labor area, in the agricultural fields, all over. Poor people get paid less, obviously. Poor people pay more, and consumers, whole books written on the poor pay more. That's where a lot of the worst food products are dumped, in the low-income areas in the cities. That's where the loan sharks are operating, and a lot of these are funded, the trace right back to Wall Street financiers, like the payday loan rackets and the other payday loan rackets. You're talking tens of billions of dollars here. So I think they're not changing, except for some small companies, Patagonia, Interface Corporation, You know, the Social Venture Network is a trade association for progressive companies that had Ben & Jerry's, for example, and Esprit years ago, and the Body Shop. But the big guys are really a difference in kind, not just degree, from smaller business. And they run the show. You know, they escape taxes. They have tax havens overseas. They shape a lot of foreign policy. Look at the oil industry, for example. So where are we? Where are we where a CEO can lose his job by saying the wrong words? Just the wrong words, like a racist word. But he can exploit the heck out of people, health, safety, economic disadvantage, and get a bonus. That's where we are.
Do we need a different system? Because as I think back to my graduate school days, I'm reminded of the fact that Karl Marx said that all this stuff was inevitable in a capitalist democracy. Do you think it's inevitable, or do we need to become more of a socialist country, or can we change it inside the framework of democracy that we've built?
Well, I don't think there's such a thing as a capitalist democracy, unless they're all small business. There's a difference between corporate capitalism and capitalism. My father was a restaurateur, delicatessen bakery, and if he didn't make it, he'd go bankrupt.
Right.
There's nobody to bail him out. But right. The big corporations, when they're in trouble, they don't go bankrupt. They go to Washington for a bailout, handout, subsidy, guaranteed loans. I mean, you got companies now, as you know, they say, well, we'll open a chip factory in Ohio or upstate New York. How much are you going to give us to make a profit, state government, federal government? You know, Biden has $52 billion laid out for that kind of subsidy. I mean, that's not capitalism. That's corporate socialism. Capitalism is you risk your own money as a company. The total hypocrisy is beyond belief here. As far as socialism, there's different kinds of socialism. You know, Bernie Sanders calls himself a democratic socialist. What he really means is a social safety net, the way they have in Western Europe and in Canada. Mm-hmm. Universal health care, paid family leave, paid child care, you know, retirement benefits, and so forth. He doesn't support the nationalization of banks and industry. At least he doesn't say so. Right. So in that sense, he's just like a New Deal Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Democrat, which is a radical thing today. They call him a leftist. So we have to simply talk about power to the people. When was the last time you saw a candidate running for office being asked the question, oh, you want to become a senator and representative? Yeah. Governor? Yeah. Well, what's your platform on making the people more powerful so they can hold you accountable and so you don't go back to Washington and get all that corporate money, campaign money, and turn Congress against us after we voted for you? Well, they never ask the question. It comes down to the voters have got to do their homework. They do more homework on how to buy a car or how to win a bridge game, a lot of them, than how they're going to vote for the presidency or the Senate. And, you know, it's all taboo, of course. You know, when you're campaigning, you got to flatter the voters. They're, you know, they're never wrong. They're always right. When I was campaigning, I'd say, I'm not this kind of candidate. I'm going to tell you straight out that if you don't do your homework, if you don't think for yourself, then you're going to be flattered, flummoxed, and fooled. And they started talking about that. They didn't take umbrage. I did this all over the country. You know, I was the only candidate campaigned every time in 50 states, from Hawaii to Maine.
Well, you know, first of all, Mr. Nader, let me say you've proved yourself time and time again that you stand up for people. So I think you have great credibility there. But let me ask you, you've run four times for president, twice in the Green Party, once in the Reform Party, once as an independent. Is America ready for a strong third party, or is the party system itself antiquated? Do we get rid of parties and build coalition like they do in other countries?
Well, we don't have a parliamentary system, as you know. And so a party can win the presidency, be blocked by the Senate filibuster, or the opposing party controlling the House or both houses, and it's hard to get anything done. Where in parliamentary systems like Canada, England, Germany, France, Italy, Scandinavia, whatever, if a party wins the election, it wins the decision power. It cannot be stopped or has a coalition. In other words, the ministers in the party are the equivalent of our cabinet ministers. So there isn't this rigid separation between the executive and legislative branches. And that's why they have a better safety net. Because we can see a party coming and winning the presidency and being blocked. That's happened a lot. Or winning the Senate and the House and being blocked by a presidential veto. The founders built the system so that it's very hard to get anything done. They were more afraid of abuses by one-man rule, like King George III, that they put a lot of bumps on the road in the separation of powers and so forth. But now it's gotten much worse because the Congress has surrendered so much of its constitutional authority, the presidency, like the power to declare war. They've really given that up. The president, you know, President Biden said he'll send soldiers if China, he'll go to Taiwan's support. He'll go to Ukraine's support under NATO. But no one pointed out that, Mr. Biden, you can't go to war. Congress has the exclusive authority to declare war. You can't go to war. And the press didn't even point it out. We have tutorials, Mr. Brown, tutorials with staff in Congress, educating them about congressional authority under the Constitution, like Trump defied over 130 subpoenas and got away with it. Nixon defied 4, and he had one obstruction of justice in the Watergate scandal, and he was about to be impeached and convicted. That's why he quit. So Trump had innumerable obstruction of justice. It was a way of life in the White House, according to John Bolton, who was assistant and quit. And, of course, he defied all these subpoenas. And you talk to senators, representatives, you say, what are you going to do about it? Well, we can go to court, but that'll take all kinds of years. I said, you don't have to go to court. Don't you know about Congress's plenary power? You have the power to arrest the president or a cabinet member and detain them. There's a jail in the bottom of the Capitol. You don't have to go to court. And once you exercise it once, they'll get the idea after they've been arrested. So they don't even know their own power.
Well, let me ask you, in your book, you've written 14 books. The most interesting, I think, I want to look at is the Nader Family Cookbook. But in your book, Civic Arousal, you quote Edmund Burke, all that is necessary for evil to prevail is for good men to do nothing. But as we see bad men getting more involved in the process, what do we do about that? We have all these Trump deniers, for example. The most dire prediction is that 200 of them may get elected to the House of Representatives. What do we do about that? What can we do about that?
Well, this gets back to my point on the voters. You know, we call them five-minute voters. They make up their mind. Well, is this candidate saying the right things, making the right dog whistles here? If he doesn't like immigrants, I'm for him. You know, if he wants to put blacks in their place, I'm for him. If he wants to go after Hollywood and the breakdown of morals, I'm for him. So what they do is they believe just the words. They don't even look at the record. I mean, Trump kept saying he's going to be a big builder because he was in construction. He's going to build all kinds of public projects all over the country. He didn't do any of that. And he never had a record. He had a record of hiring 500 Polish workers for a construction job in New York who were undocumented and then cheated him on his wages. And he finally had to settle the case. And he was a failed gambling czar in New Jersey. But, you know, that that wasn't part of the equation. In other words, I don't know any society in the world where political rhetoric, not backed by rhetoric, the record of the candidate, has such sway over people's minds. And then to top it off, the Democrats don't know how to talk with these people. They don't know how to talk with a lot of blue-collar workers. They've lost the New Deal blue-collar coalition that Roosevelt and Truman developed to beat the Republicans again and again. So we have a failing Democratic Party in the control of their political and media consultants who have corporate clients throughout the year and are conflicted and don't know a ground game from a checkers game because they want to put all the ads on TV and get 15%. And so they are unable to landslide the worst Republican Party since its creation in 1854. I mean, it's a corporatist, bigoted, misogynistic, lying, violent, prone, voter suppression, anti-worker, anti-consumer, anti-women, Wall Street over Main Street, military budget without bounds party. Reduce taxes for the wealthy and the corporate. They should be landslided. But, you know, the Democrats have compromised themselves on some of these issues as well. Just reading history, can imagine with Teddy Roosevelt, Dwight Eisenhower, Senator Robert Taft, and even Ronald Reagan would have thought of today's Trump's dominated party. So I once talked to Nancy Pelosi, and she told me that she could hardly talk with these Trump people. Well, if you can't talk them, you're going to lose a lot of them. And, you know, the trends are not good for the Democrats come Tuesday. So Mark Green and I wrote two books on Trump in 2019 and 2020. They were books to be used by voters and activists, not just to be read, like Inside the White House books that came out. And the Post and the Times completely ignored them, never mentioned them. But part of the book is how to talk to a Trump voter. Part of the book is how to deconstruct Trump's rhetoric. And there's no discussion. We don't have much of a intellectual discussion, meaning using the mind instead of emotional impulses in this country.
Well, I must tell you, I've been amazed. I've been a campaigner for 40 years. I've worked on 7 presidential campaigns, and I've just been amazed at what's gone on lately. I mean, I understand that a woman's right to choose is very, very important. I have a wife and 2 daughters who are very upset about the Supreme Court decision. But I just kept on reading the polls, and it wasn't the top issue. It was the economy. The economy was the top issue, and inflation, and the Democrats just started talking about this. They just started talking about it a week ago. They talked about the Build Back Better plan and the other stuff. And I said to myself, yeah, this is crazy. It's crazy. They're not out talking about the issues that people care about. And Mr. Nader, I have no idea how they lost the blue-collar worker. You know, I said I was born to be a Democrat because I'm an orphan who was poor, who got my first decent paycheck when I became a Teamster. And the people that I grew up with in the Democratic Party, I'm 69 years old, don't seem to be there anymore.
Figure out why they lost the blue collar voter. Number one, they allowed the minimum wage to be frozen even after Obama was elected and had huge majorities in the House and Senate in 2009. He said he wanted to raise it to $9.50 by 2011. He never brought it up until 2012 campaign, number one. Number two, they never enforced the workplace safety laws, all the way from carpal tunnel syndrome to the hazards of toxics in the workplace. Number three, they didn't really show any pride in being associated with the union movement. They used the union support, but it was kind of a backdoor thing. So they never pushed for union laws that facilitated union organizing and repealed the notorious Taft-Hartley Law of 1947, the most anti-union organizing law in the Western world. And then, you know, the big one was allowing the hollowing out of communities with whole factories and industries being shipped to China and Mexico, yeah. And unemploying steel workers and auto workers and, you know, textile workers, furniture workers, you name it. And they, year after year, we tell them, what are you talking about? This isn't free trade. This is corporate managed trade. You have tax laws encouraging exporting jobs, for heaven's sake. And Clinton was pushing NAFTA and the World Trade Organization. And so you wonder why the blue-collar workers listen to Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and all these other distorters and prevaricators on their job day after day, unrebutted. The control of the public airways taken over by the corporations and their fanatic Republican talk show hosts. You know, the Democrats, liberals, asleep at the switch. That's what they are. And we're going to pay the price maybe on Tuesday in ways that were completely avoidable, completely preventable. We put out a whole platform, Mark Green and I, starting in the spring. You can see it at winningamerica.net, winningamerica.net. And it's designed to have 24 civic leaders and advocates, everyone from Heather McGee to David K. Johnston to Jim Hightower, how to win an election against the Republicans. You know, using the language, policies, messaging, strategy, tactics, rebuttals, slogans. They don't even have slogans. They don't even know how to boast. They can say, you know, we had $300 a month child tax credit for 58 million children, cut child poverty by a third, and the Republicans blocked its extension in January 2022. Who do you want to vote for? See?
What?
WinningAmerica.net.
WinningAmerica.net, and we'll post that on our website, by the way, in case you don't have a pen to write it down with now. Let me ask you, when the Republicans inevitably take over the House of Representatives on Tuesday, everybody that's anybody in America is predicting that, and there's now even dire predictions that we might lose the Senate. This is going to, in my opinion, have a special impact on the citizens of Washington, D.C., because Congress controls the District of Columbia. They've already had two Republicans, one who's put forth legislation that would change our voting laws, another would get rid of the city council and our mayor. I fear that Washington's going to become a whipping boy for this new right-wing Republican Congress, since they absolutely control our city, ultimately, that they're going to hold us up as an example and try to interfere with just about everything we do in the District of Columbia. What do you think about that? You think that's a possibility?
Yeah, it's a possibility. It goes back a long way. Or somebody from South Carolina chair a committee, and
right.
they run D.C.
So, yeah, absolutely.
Well, as you know, because you were there, we had a whole afternoon at Constitution Hall in September 2016 on D.C. statehood.
Yep.
And we had a lot of prominent people there. Mark Plotkin, the great advocate, we miss him terribly, was
great
there.
Advocate.
Former mayors were there. You were there. We invited three times Mayor Bowser. She couldn't be bothered. She was not there. But we posted all over, posters all over D.C. Only 300 people showed up in a convention hall of 3,300 seats. So why do I say that? Because there isn't the fervor, except for a few activists. You could hardly get a rally in Washington, D.C., over 100, 200 people on statehood. And as a result, when the Democrats controlled Congress, they could have pushed a bill through in 2009, 2010. They could have made a fuss in the last year and a half when they had narrow control of the Senate and the House. It's almost like, well, you know, it's not so bad in D.C. They don't treasure the full measure of the vote. So that's been our frustration. I'm sure you share that with D.C. advocates. I just couldn't believe with all the speakers, constitutional law experts and former city council people and local activists in Constitution Hall, and even the local D.C. press wouldn't give it publicity. Even the local public radio wouldn't give it publicity. But we did poster it everywhere.
I remember it well. And the saddest thing about that, Mr. Nader, is I could name 200 of the people that showed up because of the same 200 people that show up for everything. You know, that's our
right.
problem. You know, I mean, really, I speak to these crowds of 100 people, and I know 75 of them because they come, you know, they're the core group you just talked about, which is unfortunately very, very small. President Biden.
Well, maybe the very aggressiveness of the Republicans in Congress will stir more people up, and they'll see that they're going to lose what few rights they do have.
Well, that's our hope, you know. And as Frederick Douglass said famously, it's not the light we need. You know, we keep on going and explaining to Congress that what we want to do is constitutional. Every member of Congress understands it's constitutional. They just don't give a damn. They only care about having two more Democrats in the Senate. But as Douglas said, it's not the light we need, it's the fire. And maybe this will light a fire. I hope it does.
Well, I thought, you know, once there was a rally with Mayor Gray, you remember that down
there? Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
41 of us got
Willard
arrested.
Hotel. And we were all there. And I suggested there be signs on the Maryland and Virginia border inside D.C. saying, welcome to the D.C. colony, because there's not enough outreach around the country to put pressure on Congress. We're the only capital known in the world that doesn't have the vote, the full vote for the for the parliament in those countries. Even authoritarian regimes that go through the mirage of an election. Their state, their national capitals have, the people have the vote, like everybody outside the capital. And I think it's an infuriating thing, but we got to get people infuriated outside in the congressional districts as well as inside. I got to tell you a funny story, Mr. Brown. At that rally down by the Willard, Dick Gregory was there, as he was to thousands of rallies.
Yeah, he was.
And I knew him from way back. So I walked up to what is like the dais that they set up, and I tapped him on the back, and I said, he was looking forward, and I tapped him on the back, and I said, Mr. Gregory, is this your first rally? And he turned around with the most disbelieving look you could ever have. And then we gave each other a big hug. What a great man. We really miss him.
What a great man. And can I tell you, I want you to know, Mr. Nader, that your suggestion didn't completely fall on deaf ears. My house is the first house that you pass in the District of Columbia. So in my front yard, the size of a billboard is a sign that says, warning, you are entering the District of Columbia. Residency here may result in the loss of your basic civil rights. Loss of your rights does not relieve you of any obligations you might have to the state. Taxation without representation. And I want to tell you, I put that sign up 18 months ago, and just this weekend, when my wife was raking leaves, six people stopped to have their picture taken in front of the sign. So it's been a big success. I was sure the neighbors would be infuriated and make you take it down, but they haven't. So
well, it's a perfect example of what one family can do. Right. Just think of how many cars go by there, and they get the message. People from outside D.C. and people inside D.C. Imagine if 100 homes did that.
Yeah, get exactly. It going. Well, you know what I'm trying to suggest to the city council? That it ought to be a codicil on real estate contracts. If you need to know that you're buying a house in a floodplain, or you need to know some of the other things you need to know, should you buy a house in the District of Columbia without understanding that you're going to lose your basic civil rights? I think most people that move to the District of Columbia have no idea that they're going to lose their representation in Congress and control over their own local budget. So we're going to see if we can't get the city council to take a variation of my sign and make it a real estate codicil. I think the real estate companies will pitch a fit over it, but we're going to see what we can do.
That's a very creative idea. Anything that can get the conversation about statehood a daily conversation.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, President Biden says democracy's on the ballot. When we sent out an e-blast announcing that you were going to be on the show, we mentioned that we were going to talk about the election and what's at stake. What do you think is at stake here if these Republican deniers take over Congress, take over the House?
Yeah, I mean, we're dealing with American fascism. There's no question. Number one, they're for the corporate state. They just like the judges they support all the way to the Supreme Court. Whenever it's corporations against workers, against consumers, they favor corporations. So the Republicans have always been for government-guaranteed capitalism. They never want to admit that. They always like to talk about the free market. There's no free market for the nuclear power industry and all these corporations at the trough in Washington. It's half of what our federal government does, shoveling out subsidies, handouts, giveaways, guarantees, economic quota protections, you name it. So the second example why it's fascist is they want to suppress the vote, purge the vote, not count the proper vote, discriminate against people who they think are going to vote against them in the way they're enforcing the vote, intimidating volunteer precinct workers. And that's what fascism does. It tries to snuff out all potential opposition. The third is they're taking over the media. You have Sinclair Media, the biggest over-the-air owner of television stations now. It's like an arm of Trump. You have Fox News, like an arm of Trump. And they're not going to allow dissenting voices on the media. They're going to discourage it and harass and use corporations as their advance guard to snuff out dissent. Even though the people own the public airways, they're the landlords, and the companies have rigged the system at the Federal Communication Commission where they control 24 hours a day who says what and who doesn't on radio and TV, and they don't pay any rent to us. They get it free, the public airways. You think that would be an issue? Yeah. You know, people don't even know what they own in this country. If you ask people, Mr. Brown, who owns the greatest wealth in America, you know, they would say, like, the super rich, Wall Street, the big companies. Well, they do own a lot of wealth, but the greatest wealth in America is owned by the people. Trillions of dollars of savings, money market, pension funds, the public airways owned by the people. The huge public lands onshore and offshore, the trillions of dollars of government R&D that were pushed to create all these industries, the aerospace, a good part of the pharmaceutical industry, the nanotech, the biotech, the computer industry, the internet industry. It's all taxpayer money. So we own all this, but we've been stripped of control. The corporations control all this. You think this would be a wonderful issue for the Democrats to push? It would be hard for conservatives to say, no, we don't believe that the people who own these important assets should control them. Hey, that's one of the principles of capitalism, isn't it? That if you own property, you should have some measure of control. You shouldn't be forced to give up almost total control over it. The Wall Street brokerage control all those trillions of dollars. The brokerage firms, the Fidelity, Vanguard, all these firms, they control people's savings, trillions of dollars. And those trillions own a majority of the stock on the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ. It's never discussed. So these American fascists, and you can imagine what they're going to do for the military budget, the bloated, wasteful military budget. And an area you've worked in, Mr. Brown, public budgets. Imagine how they're going to strip them and basically allow more of our infrastructure to crumble. So it's going to be bad news. They'll try to roll back consumer health and safety. They'll try to block any further expansion of health insurance and roll that back. There isn't anything they won't roll back because they are the advanced guard in our political system of what corporations demand. And what corporations demand is insatiable. There's no end to it, and they're seeking a profit, the big corporations.
Well, we have a better political system if everything was publicly, if all elections were publicly financed, if politicians didn't need to pander to these people constantly to get the money to run. Just a special election in Georgia for the Senate last time, $800 million was spent in that one campaign by both sides. So if politicians didn't have to pander as much to these people to get the money, would we have a better system?
Yeah, we would have. It wouldn't be a solution for all the problems of corporate influence in politics, but it would certainly take a big chunk out. Of course, right now, for example, we have all this dark money that Senator Whitehouse has exposed in his new book, The Scheme. You ought to have him on from Rhode Island. And all this dark money, never mind PACs and, straight checks, all this dark money seeping in, undermining progressive candidates. They're going after Summer Lee in Pittsburgh because she had the temerity to challenge corporate power. 30 years ago, someone running for the president would spend no more than $100 million. There's $100 million being spent in congressional race, just one congressional race, never mind a Senate race. So it's a completely corrupt system, completely out of control, out of disclosure. The Federal Elections Commission is split 3-3, and so it's always gridlocked because three have to be Republican, three Democrat. So that should be discussed. But you don't see Democrats discussing that. Of course, you don't see Republicans. So the people have to shape the agenda. Before election, months before election, people in every congressional district get together and summon the candidates. They summon them to town meetings. And they say, you're going to sit in the audience and listen to us. And this is our agenda. And this is what we want you to campaign on. And we want to know what you stand for. And we want it in writing. I mean, why is that so hard? Can you imagine how much time and concentration people spend on bridge? If people spent as much time on elections, training themselves, being skilled, persisting, as they spend playing bridge, these bridge tournaments are incredible expressions of talent, skill, determination, concentration. Never mind bird watchers There are like 15 million bird watches. How many Congress watches are there, Mr. Brown?
not that many, I can tell you. And yeah, it's just amazing. And of course, that's really the other side of the coin, right? Is that, you know, we become addicted to the soundbite, but the soundbite wouldn't work if people really gave a damn and looked into issues and cared about things, and they just don't. I mean, I remember I grew up in North New Jersey. Now everything, I think every mayor that was elected in North was sent to jail. But my Italian grandmother, she always voted for the Italian, regardless of how corrupt he was. You know, we'd say to her, he was just seen on the front page of the New York Times with the Gambino family. And you know what she would say, Mr. Nader? It was the anti-Italian press. Anti-Italian press. Whoever heard of that? Whoever heard of that? But that was her attitude. Yeah. That you, but she was Italian. You voted for the Italian. You didn't care. She didn't even have to know who the guy's name was. Who the guy was, if she knew that his name was Italian. And unfortunately, we do all too much of that. Well, look, we're running out of time.
Well, you know, we've tried everything. Tried everything, writing, putting things down concisely, pamphlets. One of my small paperbacks your listeners might be interested in, it's called Breaking Through Power. It's easier than we think. And it gives all kinds of examples where people said, we've had enough. We represent majority opinion for this change and this reform, and we're going to get it. And they got it throughout American history. So that book, Breaking Through Power, it's easier than we think. And at the end of the book, it has a formal summons for people to summon their member of Congress to town meetings at a local place like a school auditorium or town hall and present the people's agenda. The big lie in this country, and it's pursued by both parties because divide and rule has been a political technique for over 2,000 years, is that people in this country are irrevocably polarized. Well, they are on some of these issues that these candidates pursue, like on abortion. But look at all the issues where left-right support. You got left-right workers supporting higher minimum wage, universal health insurance, cracking down on corporate crooks. You got people wanting juvenile justice reform, which 15 state legislatures passed, led by the organizer Donald Ross, and he got Republican and Democratic legislators together on it. I wrote a book called Unstoppable, the Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State, and around page 60, I had 24 areas of improving quality of justice and life in America supported by enough left-right people to go over 70%, 80%. And if you do that, it's unstoppable. Politicians, it doesn't matter how strong the corporations are, because the members of Congress want the votes more than the cash. They want the cash to try to get the votes and deter opponents. But when push comes to shove, they want the votes. And they see 75, 80% of the people saying, we want a different kind of tax system, saying, we want a different kind of education system, saying we want to cut out this monstrous bloated military budget and bring our taxes back home to help repair, renovate, and improve our community's public facilities. Those senators, representatives are going to run for cover. They're not going to be able to stand against that. 1% of the people represent a majority of people on one issue after another in 435 congressional districts. Nobody can stop that. That's 2.5 million adults. We got the auto industry regulated with less than 1,000 people working with us around the country because the majority of the people wanted safe cars, fuel-efficient cars, pollution-controlled cars. We don't grow up understanding the power of the people. We grew up how the railroad barons and the banks and the farmer took over the farm areas and so on. We don't study civic history enough. You know, how did a few people get so many great blessings? How did they get? How many people were really fighting for the abolition of slavery? Not that many. Women's right to vote. Workers forming unions. Farmers getting banks and railroads regulated. Now, it's never more than 1%. But they represented the vast majority of their constituent. And they knew what they were talking about. That's the three-pointed way. And you got 535 members of Congress. That's all. 535. They put their shoes on, we do every day. And they want our vote. But if our vote is wholesale surrender to them, they'll turn it against us. But if it's conditioned, it's a different matter.
Well, that's the perfect note to leave on. Thank you so much for being on our show, Mr. Nader. God bless you for the work you've done for the American people. You've made us all safer and given better lives to countless Americans. And we appreciate all your hard work. We hope you'll come back again sometime. And America, you can hear this on local radio twice a week on WEAC Radio, or we archive it if you have a friend that wants to listen and wasn't here tonight. So thank you, Ralph Nader. We always leave with a song dedicated to our guests. And here's one from John Mayer. We're all waiting for the world to change. Thanks, Ralph Nader. See you next week.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.